Is it time for a mind shift? If you don't know what that means, then join your host, Dr. Clint Haycock, a former evangelical Christian pastor and Bible college teacher of over 20 years, along the journey of deconstruction and reconstruction of faith, life, religion, and spirituality.
This week, I am really excited to bring you this interview with Brielle Decker, or Brielle Decker Blanchard, as she calls herself. Now, this is not actually the name that she was born with. She changed her name from when she was in the FLDS cult, the Fundamentalist Latter-day Saints, which was, up until a few years ago, led by the quote-unquote prophet, Warren Jeffs. Now, Brielle is the very first person I have interviewed. I mean, I've talked to other ex-cult members, ex-Jehovah's Witnesses, ex-Jewish fundamentalist cult members, ex-Mormons, ex-Scientologists, too. But Brielle is the very first one that I have talked to who actually was born into a cult system that was so unbelievable controlling and still goes on, even though Warren Jeffs is in prison now for child abuse. But she was raised in a system. I mean, we're talking full-on cult compounds, barbed wire, watchtowers, guard towers, patrols, the whole thing. People trying to escape who were caught, as she will tell you about her own experiences, being relocated into more and more remote and guarded compounds way out in the middle of nowhere. I mean, we're talking, if you think about cults, like a full-on destructive cult, this is it. And as Brielle's going to talk about in this episode, she was Warren Jeffs' 65th wife. I kept getting that number confused because there's so many. He had so many wives when he finally got captured and he's now in prison. And in fact, speaking of Warren Jeffs' news, this is something very interesting. As of August 14th of this year, just a few weeks ago, Warren Jeffs, who, as I said, is in prison and has been for many, many years now, he had a mental breakdown, and his lawyers ruled he was not fit to give a deposition in a sexual abuse case, which is against him. And what they're saying is there's a woman, she sued Warren Jeffs in 2017, who says she was sexually abused by Warren Jeffs when she was a child, 8 years old. And just this last week or so, Warren Jeffs supposedly had a mental breakdown, and he's unfit to stand as a witness in this case of where he's alleged to have abused this girl. Now, talking about Warren Jeffs, before we get into this, let's give a brief overview, because we talk a little bit in this episode about the history of the FLDS, the Fundamentalist Church of Latter-day, of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, I should say, FLDS. They're a religious sect. They broke away from the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, which is, of course, the Mormon Church, over this issue of polygamy. That was about 1890. And basically what happened was the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the Mormon Church, they suspended the practice of polygamy in order to gain statehood for Utah. And in fact, this is quite a funny thing, because technically, again, if you go back to the Doctrines and Covenants, what the early Mormon Church actually taught, I mean, both Joseph Smith and Brigham Young had multiple wives. They were polygamists. They taught that God himself said that you needed to have multiple wives. So when they suspended the practice of polygamy to gain statehood, of course, there was a group of people that still wanted to carry out the practice. They believed it was God's will. And so as a result of the schism, the FLDS sect was formed in 1890, and they were actually officially excommunicated by the Mormon Church around the 1930s. In 1986, FLDS prophet and leader Leroy Johnson died at age 98. He had led the FLDS cult since 1954, at which point, from 1986 to 2002, Rulon Jeffs, who is Warren Jeffs' father, he ruled as the prophet and the leader of the FLDS until he died at age 92. Now, in September 8, 2002, his son Warren Jeffs becomes the prophet and the next head of the FLDS church. Now, we're going to get into this a little bit more, but basically, in 2006, he was put on the FBI's 10 most wanted list. He was on the run from the law from charges he'd arranged illegal marriages between his adult male followers and underage girls. He was also charged with incest, sexual conduct with minors. He was convicted in 2007 of 2 counts of rape as an accomplice, which he was sentenced for 10 years to life in the Utah State Prison. And he's now serving time in Texas. He was extradited there in, I think, 2010, where he was then found guilty of sexual assault of a child for sex with a 16-year-old he had married, and aggravated sexual assault against a child, sex with a 12-year-old he had married. He was sentenced to life in prison plus 20 years. So that's where he's at now. He's still, though, leading the cult from his prison cell. And this is also something that we're going to get into in a minute with Brielle. Now, I wanted to say real quickly that there's a couple of issues with the audio. I apologize for that. There's a couple of garbled things. I've made it as good as I could. I've tried to clean it up as best I can. Hopefully, you'll be able to understand everything that Brielle starts talking about. You can always get a hold of her. There's some good articles, in fact, in The Guardian. There's one that talks a little bit more about her story, and it goes into some a little bit more detail. And there's some documentaries on Warren Jeffs. Some of his victims have spoken out. There's a documentary on A&E. I think it's called Warren Jeffs, Prophet of Evil. So there's some more information that you can check out. Now, before I get into the chat with Brielle in just a second here, think about, if you've been listening to this show, I've been talking about the markers of cults. For example, we could apply Stephen Hassin's model, the BITE model, the B-I-T-E. Now, as you hear Brielle talk, think about, does it hit the criteria of the BITE model, for example, in terms of behavior control, information control, thought control, and emotional control, as she describes what life was like growing up in the cult and being in the cult. What was it like? Does it hit those markers of the BITE model? Just for example, use your critical thinking faculties and kind of apply that to what Brielle is going to talk about. So let's go on into it. I'm going to bring you Brielle's survivor story. It's an amazing one, surviving being the 65th wife of Warren Jeffs. And now you're going to be amazed at what Brielle is up to. So I don't want to spoil the story. Sit back and listen in to Brielle's story of what it was like to be Warren Jeffs' 65th wife. I'm so glad to be joined by Brielle Decker. Where exactly are you coming from, Brielle?
I come from Colorado City. I'm right now in Hurricane, Utah, where my adopted parents live.
Right. So you're coming to us from Utah right now. I'm absolutely fascinated to talk to you. I'm so glad that we got together because I saw your bio on Instagram. I think you were following me on Instagram just a couple of weeks ago. And I read your bio and it said you were the 65th wife of Warren Jeffs from the FLDS cult. We will say it's a cult, even though, as you were saying, that is a harsh word. We can talk more about what that actually means to you, especially having grown up in it. So what can you tell us about you? You were born into this group. What was life like growing up in the FLDS cult?
It was very, very controlled. Everything we were told over the pulpit, how we should act and think and dress and what the rules were every single day of our life till we escaped and figured out that there was more to life. But they don't even want you to do that. And they actually put up barriers for any exit route to try
so it's,
to...
Yeah, physically escape. How difficult is it to get out of this cult? I mean, physically, I know that FLDS, they have compounds around the U.S. and even up in Canada as well, don't they? So yes. if you start... And where?
Mexico.
Oh, Mexico too. So Canada, United States, Mexico, they don't have anything in Europe, do they?
Not that I know of.
Not that you know of. I know there are some groups that have compounds around the world, but the FLDS, so if you start causing trouble, they can relocate you, can't they, to another compound, even more remote, and thereby make it even that much more difficult to escape the group. Is that right?
Yes.
Did that ever happen to you? Were you ever forcibly moved to another place?
Yes, I was many times, but I did get to where I could. I kind of worked my way back to an older compound that had exit routes, like people I could run to. Because in the newer compounds, they had a gate around it and a guard tower. And if you try to escape, like you don't even know where the neighbors are. So like they have the big piece of land and you can't see. And they could drive around the perimeter every 15 minutes. So yeah, you don't know if there's even a neighbor close by. And if you did run, they would probably catch you.
Did you ever run and then get caught, or did you get out the first time you tried to get away?
I got caught many times trying to escape.
And then that was what led them to relocate you to more remote places?
Yes, but I did work my way to an older compound, so I psychologically played their games. Warren Jeffs believes in God, so I would use his doctrine against himself. So like he would say to his people that if we wanted to believe anything, that we got our own impressions from God, if we wanted to think that, you know, we got our revelation from God ourselves, we had to ask him if it was really from God or the devil.
Right. So he was in that much control even over your supposed revelations from God.
Yes. And so I would listen to his interpretations on his trainings. And I would say, you said this. And so he could never tell me that it was from the devil, because he couldn't be from the devil.
Ah, so very cleverly you beat him in his own game then, really, it sounds like.
Yes, and I fought for 3 years before I was able to make it to the compound that I could actually run to somebody that could help me.
So it was the long game really then, huh? You had a long strategy in mind. Well, you couldn't have escaped, it sounds like, from, as you were saying, some of these more remote compounds, they're that far away from everything. I've seen some of that on the Escaping Polygamy show, where they might be trying to find a woman somewhere, and they have since relocated her to an extremely remote location. You don't even know where the person is from the outside looking in. You can't find them. They're certainly not going to tell you where they have relocated her.
Right. Yeah. So I had to, because I was in the inside, I had to work my way to the outside. And I did that I had to try things. I had to use his doctrine, you know, and fight until he decided to move me. What actually made him move me was because my biological family lived in Colorado City, which is an older compound. And he told me that there's a scripture, because I don't know if you have any Mormon background. It's different than the regular mainstream Mormon. Some, you know. Quite a bit,
yes.
Actually, it's more, the regular Mormons are more lenient. This is a branch off of that. So if you listen to their doctrine, that's where they got their beginning doctrines, is from the LDS Church, and they make their own twist on it and do their own interpretations. But one of their doctrines is in the Doctrine and Covenants, and it says if you don't understand the scriptures by the time you're 8 years old, then the sin goes on the head of the parent. So this is an actual doctrine that I use. Well, they told me that I needed to go and blame all my sins on my father, and then I could come back and be a part of working with the children inside of this cult. So I took the opportunity to leave and go and live with my father, who was in this older compound. That's how I actually got there.
So very clever to work the system, really. It sounds like it was a hard thing to do, but you were very smart in figuring out, okay, I can use the theology of the group against them to work my way back to my father anyway, and then from there, get out.
Yeah.
Well, what was life like, though? I'm really curious, going back now to your upbringing in this cult. So you were born into it. Where exactly were you born then?
I was born in Sandy, Utah, which is about 4.5 hours away from Colorado City, where the older compound is that my father lived in.
So you're born there and you were raised in the group.
Yeah. And I went to Alta Academy, which is a kind of a famous school that Warren Jeffs was the principal at the whole entire time that it ever existed. It's like a homeschool that only FLDS children went to, and Warren Jeffs was the principal. So I went to that school till I was in sixth grade. And then all the Jeffs moved down to Colorado City, because he was like combining everybody. In Salt Lake, in the area of Salt Lake, is a bigger city, and everybody was kind of spread out in their own, and they had more freedom. So they started to say, when the Olympics came to Utah 1 year, and it was quite a while ago, when I was 16, and I'm 33. So when the Olympics came to Utah, then Warren Jeffs used that to say that everybody needed to move to a compound, which was Colorado City first. And then he built other compounds later. He gathered everybody together in one area.
And what was his reasoning behind? He was obviously using the Olympics as an excuse, is it a power grab so he could control everybody in sort of one or two places?
Yes, he wanted to have like cameras on people. He couldn't do that very well when everybody's spread out.
He wanted to be able to literally control people and have CCTV and everything. Well, I did a little bit of reading on him, and it sounds like his father, he took over when his father passed away, of the FLDS church or cult, whatever you want to call it. It turns out he married most of his father's wives right away within a very short time of him becoming the president of the FLDS church. Is that true?
Yes, it is. It was not one of those, though. I was an actual wife just to Warren.
So
I was married to his father.
Yeah, how many wives did his father have when Jeffs took over the cult?
I think he had 65 altogether.
So,
number 65 to Warren Jeffs.
And how old were you when you got married to Warren Jeffs?
I was barely 18, like 18, 2 months and 1 day.
So you were fortunate, I guess fortunate is in air quotes, but I mean, because I know he married girls as young as 12 from what I've read. So, you know, the fact that you were at least 18, it doesn't make it maybe any better, but that's horrifying. So anyway, so going back, you went to Alta School. That was where he was the principal, right? And it's an FLDS school. What kind of things were they teaching you? What was the curriculum like?
So everybody had to be at school by 8 o'clock in the morning. And the first hour of the day was all about the church and about what was required by his father, Warren's father, and all the leaders before him. It was just about a whole study of how we act and how we can dress and how we can comb our hair. And we believe in polygamy. So that was really stressed, how to get along in a family that was huge and what works and what doesn't work. And, you know, basically he called it all revelation from God, but basically it was people's experiences. And he figured out the only ways that might make it even be tolerable.
Yeah, on the subject of polygamy, is it true that what makes them the fundamentalist Latter-day Saints is the fact that they believe in this doctrine of polygamy, whereas the kind of mainstream Mormon church, the LDS church, obviously they used to teach that when Joseph Smith started the church back in the 19th century, but they've gotten away from that now, haven't they? Technically, the Mormon church is not supposed to be polygamous. Is that what really separates the FLDS from the regular LDS or the mainstream Mormons?
Yes. Ever since that separation, there's been many, many differences. So that was quite a while ago that they separated. And now, like the mainstream Mormon church, their focus is family and uniting people and stuff. And the FLDS have split up everybody and said they're all church property. Children are all owned by the church. So it's just progressed in a different way with the same doctrines starting it.
When did the FLDS split away from the mainstream LDS church? You know when time-wise that was?
So like it went Joseph Smith and then it went Brigham Young. These are the leaders. I don't remember the year because I'm not good with dates.
But right.
Joseph Smith, Brigham Young, John Taylor was the third leader of the LDS church. And that's when the split was. And then now there's like six more leaders after that on both sides.
Right. So it's been probably somewhere around 1900, somewhere in that area, I would imagine, because I don't know the dates either, but I know Joseph Smith, he was in the late 1800s, wasn't he? So it had to have been early 1900s, somewhere around there. So probably, somewhere around 100 years in that ballpark? Right, about a century? Yeah, I can look up those dates later. I'm now curious to go do some more research on the subject.
Yeah.
So in school, did they teach, you mentioned you talked about polygamy when you went to school. Did they teach that as this is what you're going to become as a good Mormon woman and wife when you grow up? You're going to be married to a man who might have 3, 4, 5, 6, 10 wives?
They put it like kind of more like, if you don't do this, you will be damned to hell forever.
So they tied hell right into it.
Yeah, and if you do this, then this is how you do it. So.
What's in it for the women? Because I doing my reading a bit before talking to you, what they teach in the FLDS, what I read was that men, the only way they can get into heaven is to have 3 or more wives. Is that right? Is that what you understood the doctrine to be?
Yes, the men have to have 3 or more. The women, they also only get to go to heaven if the husband has 3 or more.
So yeah, it only counts for them if they're part of a family of at least 3 or more wives. So if the guy has only 2 wives, they're not going to make it into heaven.
The highest degree, they're not going to make it to the top where they want to be, because that's where Jesus and all the gods are.
So for example, if an FLDS man only had, let's say, 1 wife. They could get into heaven, but it would be like a lower level of heaven. Is that how it sort of works? The more wives you have, the higher up you go in the sort of hierarchy of heaven?
Yes. And they teach that if you progress on earth, if you learn on earth, you progress like way faster than if you wait until you go to heaven. Like if you haven't been cast out of heaven, then you have like you can still progress after death, but you it's just slower.
The slower progress. So did you buy all this stuff when you were a little girl growing up in this system? Was it all just you accepted it all as true, or did you question it even then?
As a little girl, I kind of bought into it. I had a lot of peer pressure at school. Everybody would just, we were kind of like, you know, our brains obviously weren't developed all the way, like, you know, all children. But we'd hear the stories and we'd have all the authority figures and all the people that we idolized putting pressure on us, telling us stories about how if we don't stay faithful to the church, then we will have this consequence and this consequence and this consequence. So we go back to class and all of our friends would talk about how I can't believe that they didn't stay faithful to the church. Like, why did they not stay faithful to the church? And it wasn't until after I went into Warren Jeff's family and started to realize the differences between my father's interpretations and Warren Jeff's interpretations that I started to really, really question. Like, it was later in life for me because my father's interpretations were quite lenient.
So what were the differences? You mean interpretations of the Bible or what?
Or of
what
the FLDS doctrine.
Of their doctrine, right. But Warren Jeffs being the supposed prophet, was he in this position where he could sort of dictate, this is what God's telling me and this is what the new doctrine is? Was that sort of how it worked?
Yes. It was very much like he had his teachings, but he himself acted different than his teaching. So when you got to know him on a level that most people didn't ever get to know him that good, he was mean. He was very harsh. He didn't apply his own doctrine to himself.
Right. Can you give me an example of what you mean? What kind of an example would it be?
So like, there's a doctrine in the Doctrine of Covenants, another one that I didn't talk about before, that says persuasion through love. Everything's supposed to be persuasion through love. And inviting and, you know, not fear-based. Well, Warren Jeffs is definitely fear-based. Everything he does is about correction and punishment. And so my father kind of took the persuasion through love really literally, and my mother did. And so they only heard his doctrines, and they always switched in their mind and just decided that he was merciful and kind and all the nice things about God they focused on. But Warren Jeffs did the opposite of that. He would focus on judgment and, you know, that kind of stuff. So it was almost impossible to make it to heaven. After I studied, I went into Warren Jeff's family and studied like almost solid. And the thing I figured out is that Warren Jeff had so much power, he actually taught that you could become a god in heaven and fall, like you could fall from heaven and have all your former sins returned if you forget a prayer.
So something that sort of minor could cost you everything.
Yeah, because all your former sins return upon you. So basically, it was all a mercy thing. Like, he decided who was worthy and who wasn't worthy because he was the leader and the leader couldn't do wrong.
Yeah, so, the cult leader can do no wrong, basically.
Yeah, and so, like, in heaven, all the gods can't do wrong. But if you've never made it into a prophet position, then you're always at risk of falling from heaven.
That's unbelievable. So he was definitely the top guy. Was everybody sort of striving to get close to Warren Jeffs? Is that sort of how it worked in terms of the psychology of the group?
Yes, everybody was supposed to think like him, act like him. He called it oneness. If they weren't, that's how they could tell if they were like God, is if they were doing what Warren Jeffs would do.
So how would he get the word out? Let's say your typical day in the life of this cult, you're doing all the things you're supposed to do. How do you know when Warren Jeffs has come out with a new pronouncement? Do you have services? Because they do have temples, don't they, on some of the compounds? I know there's the one, is it in the Yearning for Zion compound in Texas? There's a temple. There's actually a temple they built on the compound. So they have services and all that?
Yeah. So the lower levels, they have like the old compounds where people have never been heard about Warren Jeffs for a long, long time. He set it up before he left. They would listen to his reported training every morning and every evening, whether he was around or not, and try to live up to those trainings. And then if he decides at any time to call them, he can take their child, call up randomly and say, you're worthy of another level. And then they get to advance into the next level and hear those trainings and continue on listening to them every morning and every night. Never stop the morning and night thing. Just get more controlling, like more intense.
So how would he actually do it? How does these recordings get out to all? Because obviously you've got different compounds, as you say, Canada, America, Mexico. He's trying to get his teaching across to everybody. How did he actually do it? Was it like you log in on an internet website and download his stuff, or how did it do it?
So it's
right, you're that controlled.
It's his same trainings that he taught when he was in Alta Academy. He started Alta Academy when he was 17. He became the principal of Alta Academy and experimented on children to start with. And that was way before I was born. But he started his trainings and recording them then. So when everybody was not so spread out, he talked about how he wanted everybody to listen to him every morning and every night. And then it became a commandment. And so then that's how they got a hold of his trainings first, just because they were not spread out at that time.
Were they like recorded videos?
They're audio recordings of Warren Jeffs telling people how to live.
Right. So even if he wasn't physically present, he could still get his commandments out no matter where people were or no matter where he is. Because, of course, he's in prison right now. We can talk about this later, I think. But he's still essentially running the cult from his prison cell, or he's trying to. Isn't that right?
Yeah.
So he's not willing to give up any little bit of control. So now let's go back to your story. You're growing up. So you went to this school, even though you bought into the doctrine and everything else. What did you do? How did you end up marrying Warren Jeffs when you were 18? How did that all come about?
I believe in appointed marriage. So that is when the leader decides who everybody belongs. And he actually had a quote that said, if you leave the choice to God, you'll get the best. I don't believe that anymore, but
you don't believe it.
Because everybody's, you know, human, I believe now. So
right.
Anyway, he taught that if you leave your marriage choices up to God, he actually taught if you don't leave them up to God, you'll be cast out of the church and lose your entire family and everything you've ever known.
So it was all down to him. Because he wasn't he the, as what I read, he was the sole authority who could appoint not only marriages, but if he felt like a husband, for example, wasn't living up to his teachings, he could take his wives as well as his home and his possessions from this guy and reassign them to another man. Did you ever hear of that happening?
Yes, that actually happened really like drastically. Like, there's this doctrine about persuasion through love. I get married. He sends me home to my father's house and tells me to go to a meeting in the morning. That was a community meeting. You know, everybody's going to be there. So I show up at this meeting and he walks down the aisle and passes out some of those corrections, like some of those punishments to fathers that I had known for years and looked up to as a child. He's passing out these corrections, telling them that they no longer have a family, that they no longer have any of their kids. Don't belong to them anymore. They need to go on repentance missions where they leave and just find a home somewhere and just pray to someday get a call that they can come back and see their family. So he wanted me to witness that. That was his whole point of having me go to that meeting, was to witness that he was going to punish a whole bunch of people.
Yeah, how much power he had.
This is nothing about persuasion through love. And this is the day after I got married.
So he was showing how much authority he really had. So you could, it was all a power play, so you could see this actually going down, huh?
Yeah. And I felt like there's hopeless. Like, I just felt completely hopeless. Like, there's not a chance. If all these men that I've looked up to and have tried so hard their entire lives, how am I supposed to get anywhere? So I took a different route than most of the people. He told everybody to take a route of just praying all the time and God will give you the answers. But then if God doesn't, then it's your fault. So I just went to the scriptures. I went to the word and tried to fill my mind with some real solutions. I'm like, it's not working what he's saying. So I'm going to try to find a different route.
So you weren't buying necessarily his teaching. Well, how did it end up that you were married to him? Did he come to you and say, I've chosen you, you're going to marry me? Or did he go to your parents? How did it actually work?
He went to my father, and my mother didn't even get invited to the wedding.
Really?
Yeah. He was on the run from the law, and he was running from all officials. So he only had the least amount of people as possible show up at the wedding. So all it was two of his brothers, because we had to have three witnesses, two of his brothers, him, me, and my father. That was it in the wedding room. No wedding dress. He actually told my father to tell me we were going on a drive. And he just had a spiritual wedding. It wasn't even legal. Couldn't be legal. And sent me home that night. We never consummated the marriage.
You never did?
Never did.
Was that, and that was because he was on the run?
It's because he's a pedophile, and I was 18. So he just wanted me as a concubine.
So yeah, why did he want to marry you? I was mentioning before, in a way, you're too old for Warren Jeffs at 18. That's incredibly young anyway. But he was definitely a pedophile. We know he abused, well, he married a girl that she was age 12.
Right.
And consummated the marriage. And another girl was 15. Those are the two charges, well, two of the charges that they finally were able to bring him to justice on, as well as some other things. So
he's
why did he marry you?
He's a pedophile, though. He's kind of like a narcissist. So he wants he wants control, too. So if he sees that you have been obedient and faithful and stuff, he kind of took people as servants, you know, like basically people that would. But I can't say that he never had relationships with any of his older ladies, but it was really rare.
So he was more interested in obviously the very young girls. But he was also accused of abusing boys, too, when he was principal of the school, I seem to recall. Did that come out as well?
It never came out in the church. I mean, I know I've heard it, and I believe it, since I've left. But it never, ever came out. Like, FLDS still, to this day, believes our leader can't be wrong, and that everything is falsified. He's in jail for false reasons. They hide all the children that he had, his young brides. Everybody doesn't believe he really had relationships with them in there, the ones that are still following.
Yeah, the ones that are still, and there are a lot of people. I read somewhere that at its height, there may have been about 15,000 members. Does that sound like about a good number to you as far as the size of the FLDS cult?
Yes, it's a lot of people, and they just believe so much in God and in their faith and the interpretations that they believe. A lot of them never even met him. Like the children nowadays, he's been in jail for more than 10 years. A lot of them don't even know him. They just believe this fantasy world that he's really good.
They're still following his teachings and his leadership from the prison cell, basically. I know that he's had some issues in prison. He's gone on some hunger strikes, and he wrote a book and all this kind of stuff saying that God has spoken to him. And one of the things God said was that you need to release Warren Jeffs from prison, conveniently.
Many times.
Yeah. How convenient. Well, he's the prophet of God, of course. So it's fascinating, though, when you actually look at it, how long have you been out now from the cults? Now that you're looking at it from the outside, how has your view of it changed from when you were in it and receiving all their downloads, as it were, their indoctrination?
I knew more when I went into Warren Jeffs' family. I researched so much. I had more knowledge when I left than most people do. Most people, when they leave, they just give up. They still believe in it. They just give up. Then they come
they
out
can't
here
do
and
it anymore.
Start to change. Yeah, they can't do it anymore. But so what? They start to change when they get out here.
Right.
That's
so, yeah.
I knew when I was running, it was almost life and death to me.
You had to get out. Yeah, it was. Because what was the thing if you'd have gotten caught that last time? What did you believe was going to happen to you? You'd been caught many times before, relocated. I mean, obviously, you were very clever in working your way back, like you said, to the other compound where you knew then you could make a desperate bid for freedom. But then what would have happened, do you think, if you'd have gotten caught that last time?
I think I would have died. I really do. But
you think that they would have murdered you or?
Yes.
Wow.
I think so. But if because they did tell me some things when I was living in their house stuff, but that will come out in my book. It's really complicated to, you know,
right, get, you'll get into
the details in an interview like this.
Yeah, so, but you were physically threatened, though, really.
Yeah, I was physically threatened. So if that wasn't what had happened to me, then I probably would be still locked up. Like, I wouldn't have, like, I would be in prison or death. Like, there wasn't any good options for me because they were trying to say that I was crazy. They were trying to say that I was so mentally sick and so mentally ill because I knew too much.
Yeah, you knew too much.
Information that they didn't want out. They would go to any length to hide that.
Well, you were saying, going back to what your comment earlier, you said when you went to the Warren Jeffs family, this was, I guess, after you got married to him, wasn't it, where you started studying. What were you studying? What was the things you were reading up on that you say you know more than anybody else, really? What were you studying?
I was reading the doctrine, the things that Warren Jeffs interpretations on everything, and adding them up, figuring out how this is even possible.
Yeah, so you were seeing the contradictions in his own. You gave that example before. He didn't even live consistently with the things the doctrines and covenants or whatever said. So you're seeing the inconsistencies in his own teachings. Was that kind of where it all started and thinking, wait a minute, how can this guy be a prophet of God if he's so all over the place? he's not even consistent.
Yeah, that's where it started with me. I was in a house in hiding, which is a level in between compounds that are new and the older compounds. I had a place for people that were struggling to make it in the elite group. And I was in the middle of those and figured out that there was just no way that the God that I had been told about my entire life could be real. Like, there was just no way.
It's just not possible.
Yeah, it was. I believe in God still, but it wasn't the God that I had been told about.
What was the God that you had been taught? What would you say now, looking back on it? What sort of God was it?
It was a controlling, mean, strict, you know, that's not anything about love. They say there's love, but they wouldn't, you know, the time of mercy is past, you know, like that be God.
It sounds like it's an image of Warren Jeffs, isn't it? That sort of God.
Yeah, it was. It was Warren Jeffs because he claimed was God.
Yeah, they've sort of recast God in the image of Warren Jeffs, who is a controlling, narcissistic, cruel despot, really. So you're sort of deconstructing that God that you were taught, you were raised to believe was true. What was it that led you to get out? You were in this compound in Colorado, was it, that you were able to escape from?
I was in many compounds, but, you know, more than one, but I was in Colorado City, Arizona. So that's the one that I escaped from.
Oh, right. Yeah. That's the name of the compound.
Back to Colorado City. And I want to clarify, I did not do what they asked me to my father. Like, I love my father so much. And I just decided that I didn't want to do it. I took the opportunity to physically go there, but I never, ever turned him in. I didn't want to go back and help them hurt the children. I wanted their children to have more time. So if I correct the visit to me, they would have to retrain adults how to do this, and it would take them longer, and children in the religion would have more time to grow up and have more freedom. Instead of turning my father in, I made it to Colorado City where the older compound was, I didn't turn in my father, and turned in the people who did it to me. And then that's why I got locked up. Yeah, I got threatened multiple times. That was amazing that I made it out of it.
You were able to make your escape from Colorado City. Did you have any help on the outside? People that you were meeting out there to help you get away, or did you do it completely on your own?
I did it completely on my own.
So you literally just ran away.
I was literally locked in a room with screws in the window and the doorknob turned around, so it was locked all the way. I found some scissors and I listened for my brother because I was in my brother's house and he left. I listened for his truck to go to work. His family was still home. It was broad daylight. And I knew that if I waited till he came back, he would have too much time to think and he would come in and put screws all up the window. I found some scissors and I started to unscrew screws like if I could with some scissors. It's hard. I did get one screw undone all the way, and the other one was really, really tight, and it wasn't all the way in. It can out some, so I was able to pound on it and break it off. And his family heard me. They came in and took everything I was using, and I just found more stuff and pounded on the other one. The thing the family didn't know is that I'd already gotten one out. They thought there was two of them. So when I broke off the last screw, they had told me to lay on the bed and quietly leave. So when I exited the window, they thought I laid down. They didn't hear me pounding on the other screw. And because I didn't open any drawers or anything, I didn't even take my ID. I didn't even realize I needed my ID for one thing because I'd been grown up in this culture so long. But even if I hadn't known that, I wouldn't have taken it because if I opened one drawer, that would have flagged them, like they were listening for me. That would have helped them realize that I was leaving.
So you actually escaped out the bedroom window after basically unscrewing some screws that were screwed, that the window was screwed shut.
Yep.
So you got out the window. Did you take anything? Did you have any possessions that you took with you, or did you just run with the clothes on your back?
Clothes on my back. And I ran through, like I had tried to run before that incident and got caught. So the people on the road would see me and they would call them and tell them. So I actually took the Crip. So I'm in Colorado City, Arizona, which is sometimes called Short Creek because that's what it was called before it became an actual city. I ran through the streets where there weren't very many cars to try and hide from vehicles and things because I didn't want someone to see me and call my brother because I had that happen. So I ran to a family that I knew had all left together and lived in a house where I knew where they were. And right before I got to the house, I waited outside. See, I didn't have a phone and we didn't have internet access or television or radio. But I ran to a yard right before I got to the house I was running to. And it was a lady sitting outside that had outside clothes. She didn't have, like, the long dresses and the braided hair and things that people inside of the cult have. So this is an older compound, so there are people like that around. So she stopped me. She was meditating out in her yard. And she stopped me and she says, "Can I help you?" And I said, "Yes, I'm trying to get to that house up there." And she drove me up to that house and she stopped. And she's like, "Do you want me to go in with you?" And I said, "Sure, I don't care." She went in with me and she's actually the one that had the phone numbers to the cult. Because the people that I ran to had too recently left themselves and didn't even know the organizations themselves. And so I wanted organizations because I had tried the police officers here in the United States, that even the police officers that weren't FLDS ones, I had tried them. And because I had FLDS doctors that had prescribed me drugs, they had, without my signature, without my permission, usually what a doctor or a hospital record you have to sign to get your record. And I didn't check anything. But I highly suspect it was a time when I ran away. It was in Flagstaff, Arizona, which is not the not a compound, but it was 2 weeks before I escaped. I went with my brother on a business trip, walked him to the desk, and asked for the police officer. Well, the police officers talked to my brother first, and then came to talk to me, and said, because of your mental state, you have to go back. And the only way I can think of that they were able to do that was if the FLDS doctor gave my records to my brother. Without my
which is technically illegal, as you say.
Yeah, illegal. So.
But they did it anyway, obviously.
Anyway. So it confused the police officers and thought that I had signed away my rights. So when I left, I looked for peer support specialists, like people that were that had gone through similar things, because they could catch mistakes like that. People that are general people out in the world don't have this thick of layers of how to cope, you know?
Yeah.
They just don't. So I needed numbers to organizations that were in the in this field. It was actually my adopted mom now that so the family I ran to picked me up halfway and drove me halfway, and my mom picked me up halfway and drove me to her house in a neighboring town and kind of hid me away that night. The next morning, the police officers went door to door looking with a picture of me, looking for me. There was a police officer that got fired, you know, because he went overstepped his bounds looking for me, saying that I had to be the one to talk. The organization eventually told them I was safe, but one police officer thought he needed to talk to me directly. They actually put me on the missing list. I had the Department of Justice fly in from Washington, D.C. and interview me, and I was terrified. So I asked for an attorney, and they gave me the Department of Justice, and didn't even know there were different kinds of attorneys. So, you know, I just told them, I'm okay. You know, I wouldn't even hardly talk to them because I wasn't in any frame of mind to talk to them at that point. So
I can imagine.
Yeah, so that's kind of how it went when I escaped. It took me 2 years from the day I escaped to close around average of May. It was May 23rd when I escaped. I went to Tennessee. I got an attorney that was the right kind after I figured out what to ask for. And we went and changed my name legally. So my name was Lynette Warner. So if you look up Warren Jess Wise, I'm actually in the picture, but my name was Lynette. And now I've changed my name to Brielle, obviously. Brielle Liberté Decker Blanchard. I did that for security. Like, I didn't want to have my medical stuff ever default. You know, like, I didn't, if it did default, I wanted my legal paperwork to go to my adoptive family instead of my biological family that was still in the cult.
Right. So you've got family members still in the group. Do you have any contact with your biological parents?
My father did get kicked out 1 week after I escaped. They did blame everything on him, whether I didn't do it, but whether, you know, whatever I did didn't really matter that much. They were going to do what they were going to do. But they did kick him out, and he and I are on good terms. He doesn't think it was because of me. He just, you know, he's nice to me all the time. But my mother's still in it, and I have 11 sisters and brothers still in there. So
do you have any contact with any of them?
I don't. Not any of the ones in there. They can't really cross that line or they get in trouble.
So yeah, they would get in trouble if they tried to reach out to you.
Yes.
And if you tried to go back in, well, what would happen? That's the question. Are you afraid of, like you say, retribution? You were afraid you if you got caught, you could be in very, very serious trouble. What about now? What do you feel about the cult now? Well, do you feel like they're any threat to you?
They wouldn't take me back now. I'm remarried, you know, that's a big no-no, you know, like I told you about the appointed marriage.
Yeah, it wasn't an appointed marriage, so you're out on that count.
Yeah,
but do you feel like they're any threat to you?
I sometimes wonder, but then I think I'm public. They like to do everything in secret. So they would be in big trouble if they ever crossed that line. You know, it would be too hard on them. So they just try to stick with saying that I don't know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, you're one of those crazy people that's lost her mind. And yeah,
too, but I,
you're an apostate and everything.
Yeah, I'm actually 2 years now of completely being out of the hospital for any PTSD. Which before that, I wasn't solid in the hospital, you know.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. How have you coped sort of mentally, psychologically since you left the cult? Did you get, you got therapy and counseling, or what have you done?
Lots of therapy and counseling, pretty much solid, you know, every week. I've done some EMDR. Talking about my story actually helped. So I'm writing a book. I'm doing a lot of that stuff. And I don't run from my fears. I kind of face them head on. Because I think that if they don't face them, they kind of fester.
That's true. Yeah, you have to face it head on and process through it. Because I know talking to people that were in really controlling cults, that's one of the big pieces of the sort of rebuilding process. You've got to go through and unpick the conditioning and sort of walk through all the stuff they did to you while you were in the cult. And you can't ignore that. It'll just come out in other really unhealthy ways, won't it, in terms of mental health?
Yeah,
so you can't just stuff it down.
And I don't recommend, like, if you're in a domestic violence situation, to jump head on into your fears. Of course not. But I do recommend finding a safe place to explore them. So, like, when I was in Tennessee, I felt like I was not tackling my fears. I was getting something done. And eventually I went to the Salt Lake area first before I went to the Short Creek, obviously, and went and got Warren Jeff's house. I'm the one that went and got Warren Jeff's big house in Colorado City. I went and applied for it to the people that run that land there now. And I was granted it about 3 years ago on Thanksgiving Day.
So they gave you one of his old houses?
Well, they wanted it. They had 50,000 back taxes. They wanted some money for it. So I basically found a buyer for it that would help people transition from the church, you know, into the outside world. So they wouldn't have to go through so many hoops. I had a lot of things to figure out when I left. And I wanted them to have some help figuring those things out. Yeah, it wasn't like there wasn't any. It was just they needed more. Like they needed. So I went and got his house. It's 45 rooms. It was like over 50 bathrooms, 2 commercial kitchens. It's huge. And it had 3 buildings on the same lot. So I found a worldwide organization after I only had 3 months to find a buyer. And there were enormous water payments and power payments and stuff like that. So I didn't have a lot of time anyway. I didn't know what an appraisal was. They burned all the blueprints, you know, the people that were in there before. And I knew it was the community for some in that older compound that they're trying to change now into people that have left instead of people that are part of it.
So is that what you're doing now, helping people to get out of the cult?
Yeah, helping people to get out. So that's what I do now. And I sold it to this worldwide organization called the Dream Center. And yeah, they have 30 Dream Centers in India. They have a lot, they're worldwide. And their motto is find a need and fix it, find a hurt and heal it. And they try to cater to what that community needs. And in this situation, we really need temporary housing. So they do GED classes, they do whatever it takes to help somebody. And they've helped many people. And so that's what I do now. Is I work as a peer support specialist over there, which is a licensed position, which is not that hard to get. It's not a very high license, but it's still a license. And I took some classes for that. And now I'm trying.
So you're helping people get out as well as transition. Well, I think it's true that, you know, they use the term destructive cults about organizations like the FLDS. And you read books on the cults and things. And I think people have maybe think, well, it's not destructive. They're not blowing up buildings and they're not, you know, killing people and things like that. Waco, Texas, how that ended. But yet it's destructive, I would say, in the sense of the damage it does to people psychologically, as well as the sexual abuse. Is that how you see it now, looking back out, you know, from the outside in? It's really a destructive cult?
I very much think it's destructive. I think that they do everything in secret, so it doesn't look like on the surface they're as bad, but they are. They won't.
It's very damaging.
Secret. Yeah.
Well, look at
it. No, if everybody's spread out all over, how do you know somebody's even alive? Everybody in there thinks they're just in another house, but who's going to know if they really are?
Exactly. And like you said, they're actually protecting the abuser. For example, in Warren Jeff's case, you said that, you know, they're willing to, well, they turn a blind eye to it. They think he's being persecuted. He's in prison right now. He hasn't done anything wrong. He's only there because, I guess, what, Satan's come after him, or it's some sort of spiritual attack?
They say it's religious persecution.
The government just wants to shut him up because he's a prophet of God. But yet he was abusing children, possibly boys as well, certainly young girls. You know, he's a pedophile. As you say, he's an absolute pedophile, and he was using this cult as his power base in order to be able to do that to these kids.
Right.
So it's definitely a destructive cult. Well, if people wanted to get a hold of you, what's the best way to do it? Because I found you on Instagram. Is that how you're most active, or what is there other social media platforms that people get a hold of you?
The most one I'm on is Facebook, actually, Brielle Decker Blanchard. I do have a blog, but I'm still working on that one. It's not like as easy for me to communicate because I'm still working on it. It's called bloggingwithbrie.com, B-R-I, and it's like growing step by step. I kind of try to do group therapy, like on a media platform, show people how hard it really is and show people the good times when we celebrate. Right.
And you're working on a book coming out. Do you have any idea when that's going to come out, or is it a work in progress?
Our goal is November of this year.
Oh, right. So it's coming along. Hopefully you'll get it out before the end of the year then.
Yes, that's what we're hoping.
Well, listen, I really applaud your courage. I cannot believe how strong of a person you must be to have escaped, knowing that you were physically in danger. It wasn't just that you were going to be locked away at another compound. I cannot believe how strong you are. Really, I applaud you for getting out and for speaking out. Thank you so much for agreeing to be on the show.
Thank you. I'm glad for the opportunity. I think awareness comes before you can do something about it.
I'm still amazed that you had the courage and the wherewithal to study all this stuff while you were in the midst of the cult, and then come to those conclusions and then have the courage to get out. I mean, that's really amazing. So my hat's off to you for not only doing what you did, but what you're doing now, helping people to get out. So I hope that people can get a hold of you and look you up on Facebook at least, or look up your blog and hear what you have to say.
Yeah, or even Instagram is fine.
Okay, thank you, Brielle. I really, really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me, and I'll stay in touch with you.
Okay, that sounds good. Okay, thank you. Bye.
All right, I'll leave it up to you. Does the description that Brielle gave meet the criteria of a cult as defined by Dr. Stephen Hassin? The BITE model, behavior control? Yeah, talking about going to school at the Alta Academy, being taught how to live in a polygamous family, all the stuff about what the doctrines and covenants, what Warren Jeffs teaches, all about behavior control. You've got to be like him. And of course, she described information control. They did not have access to the internet. They couldn't find out what was going on in the outside world. That is a classic cult tactic, is information control. If the cult leader can control the flow of information from the outside, then of course he can control the narrative. He can also control what people learn about the cult on the internet. They might find out that he's not all he's cracked up to be. He's a false prophet. He's a liar. There's all kinds of abuses that the cult is covering up and they don't want you to know about. And we also heard her describe how Warren Jeffs would disseminate his teachings to the cult via recordings. That is also him controlling what information the cult members, the followers, receive. So I'd say it meets the criteria: behavior control, information control, thought control, and emotional control. They were told what to think. They were told what the, quote, truth was, according to Warren Jeffs, according to the teachings. And then the emotional control: you will go to hell. You could even become a god if you had three wives, if you're a man, and yet you could lose that status if you didn't have the right sort of prayers and these kind of things that she describes, and losing your family, having Warren Jeffs come into a meeting hall and just take your family away and assign them to someone else because you're not worthy. So living in fear, I would absolutely say that everything Brielle described meets or perhaps even exceeds the classic BITE model of Stephen Hassin. So again, we're going through this and saying, yeah, this is a cult, and it's a very much a destructive cult. I used that word at the beginning. Now, of course, they're not blowing up buildings. They're not, you know, killing people per se, but psychologically, the damage that they've done to so many people, and it's still ongoing. I mean, just look at what I was talking about in the introduction. All the young girls, the young people that Warren Jeffs abused when he was the principal of the academy, and then later on as the prophet and leader of the FLDS cult, he obviously used his power and his authority to abuse young girls and perhaps even young boys as well when he was the principal of the academy. As soon as his dad died, he immediately informed the other leaders of the church, nobody touches these women, they're all my wives. And from then on, he went on to marry more and more and more wives, of which Brielle was his 65th. So this guy was an unbelievable, real piece of work. I'm glad they caught up with him, and he's doing life in prison, even though he's coming up with some bullshit reason why he can't stand trial for the abuse that he did of an 8-year-old girl. So the guy is a classic figure of a cult leader. I'd say he hits all the criteria, all the markers of a classic cult leader. We're describing a cult, a destructive cult. So I'm glad that Brielle is now in a position where she can help other escapees from the FLDS cult. And of course, I don't know if you caught that part, but she actually has one of Warren Jeff's houses. She has a 44 or 45 bedroom house that used to belong to him. I think the irony is just ultimately it's delicious that she's actually using one of his former houses as a safe haven for escapees of the cult. And so that is just the ultimate irony, I think. More power to Brielle. So what are we going to be talking about in the next couple of weeks? Well, I've done an interview with Claudine Gallagher. She is a survivor of Mormonism, and she deconstructed, she deconverted, and now she's coming out and helping other people, especially in the area of religious trauma and being triggered. And we got into a long discussion about that. But I've also been doing a lot of work on the subject of the family. I don't know if you've seen the Netflix documentary based off the book by Jeff Charlotte. I've been trying to get him on the show, but I guess he's very reluctant to give many interviews anyway. But I've been doing a lot of work on Dominion theology and making the connections with the family, something that Chris Shelton and I talked about on his Sensibly Speaking podcast. If you want to give that a listen, that came out just a week or so ago. So check out Chris Shelton's Sensibly Speaking podcast, where we get into the subject of the family and how that relates to Dominion theology. I think I'm going to do a standalone episode on all the research that I've been doing. I'm no expert on Dominion theology, but I've uncovered more and more and more stuff, and it's really pretty scary, especially now that we see how the family has infiltrated not just American politics, but politics all over the world. The movers and shakers, these guys are doing all sorts of stuff behind closed doors. We have no idea what they're up to, all in the name of Jesus, supposedly. So watch out for the series, The Family. Pick up Jeff Charlotte's book, The Family, or C Street, which is his follow-up book to The Family. So we might be doing that in the next couple of weeks, but stay tuned. Also, I am in touch with both Tim Sledge and David Hayward, the Naked Pastor. They have both agreed to do a Zoom call. We're going to do a podcast in September. We're going to be talking about specifically theological and biblical deconstructions, questions by some listeners of the show as well. So if you got questions for me and Tim and David Hayward, let me know. Send me an email, send me a tweet, send me a DM on Twitter. You can follow me at MindShift2018. You can say, hey, I've got a question. I'm struggling with something biblically, theologically, whatever your deconstruction is, and we'll discuss it on the Zoom call in September. Also, speaking of Zoom calls, this is something that we've been doing for members of the closed MindShift podcast Facebook group who support me on Patreon. This is a great reward for being a supporter of the show. Not only do you get early access to the episodes on Wednesdays before they drop on the Fridays, but actually being a part of the group, we do these monthly Zoom calls. And in fact, next month in September, we're going to have Claudine Gallagher drop in as our guest. So I am really looking forward to that one. The one we did in August was absolutely fantastic. We had Conway and Siegelman drop in as guests. And of course, if you listen to that episode, you'll know that we did a podcast not long ago with the two of them. And we sat and talked to them. A bunch of us had a great conversation with Conway and Siegelman as part of our monthly Zoom call in August. So these are a feature of being a Patreon supporter of the show. So you can always find me on patreon.com/mindshiftpodcast if you want to be a supporter of the show. So thanks for listening into my chat with Brielle Decker. I hope you found her story inspirational and thought-provoking, certainly challenging. I applaud her for her strength. So catch you again in a couple of weeks right here on Mindshift Podcast.